Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org. Additional support comes from the Jackson Laboratory, researching the root causes of cancer and other genetic diseases, designated a cancer center by the National Cancer Institute, JAX.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. We have a labor deal, or half a deal, or quarter of a deal. Oh, heck, I have no idea what kind of deal it is. Ahead on Only a Game, the latest NFL news with Mike Reese. Also, Yao Ming's post-NBA plans to elevate Chinese basketball. And we'll reveal the identity of the formerly anonymous fastballer at the center of Bruce Springsteen's Glory Days. Also ahead, the group called Baseball for All strives to make Diamonds the best friend of the girls as well as the boys.
My goal is that this is no longer a news story. And girls and boys are playing baseball. It's our national pastime, and to me, it's the greatest game on earth.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. There will be NFL games. Surely. Absolutely. Just don't ask me when. But we can ask Mike Reese of ESPNBoston.com. Mike, welcome back to Only a Game.
Well, thanks for having me, Bill.
Late yesterday afternoon, the players' representatives advised all the players to, quote, stay put over the weekend, and they said that the reps would meet on Monday to review what the owners have already approved. How do you anticipate the player reps and then the players themselves will respond to the package on the table?
Well, I think they're going to like part of it, Bill, but I think the thing they want to do is slow this process down. And I think that's what this weekend and maybe early next week sort of represents for the players. I don't think they liked the idea that the owners maybe were trying to push this through a little quicker than the players wanted. They want to go over this line by line because we're looking at a 10-year agreement here. So to me, I think they'll like parts of what they see, but they'll want to revisit other parts with the owners.
The owners, of course, voted on Thursday on what they called a new agreement, after which Players Association Executive Director Demora Smith told the players in an email that there was no agreement. Are we really close to an agreement?
I believe we are, contrary to what we're hearing from some circles on both sides of this. I go back to something Dallas Cowboys owner Jerry Jones said. He said, we're down to dissecting mosquitoes at this point, or something along those lines. And I do think, Bill, I do think that's where we are at this point in the process. But again, when you look at an agreement that's going to last 10 years, I think the idea is let's not make any small mistake that could magnify itself in maybe year 6, 7, 8. And I think that's why the players are maybe looking at this saying, maybe we want to add a clause in this agreement that we could opt out in year 7 or around that time.
What did the owners have to gain, if anything, by their strategy on Thursday, which was to say, okay, we've signed this thing. Here's your agreement. Your turn.
Well, I think they gained a couple of things. First and foremost, look at the money that they would lose if preseason games aren't played. Now we know that the Hall of Fame game has already been canceled, but if you start getting into canceling full segments of the preseason, like an entire segment of weeks of games, you're talking about $250 million that they would lose just for 1 week of the preseason or right around there. So that's the first thing that they preserve by trying to push this through. But the other thing they do is they sort of put the ball back in the court of the players when you're looking at the court of public perception, if you will. And you say, okay, owners, they're ready to have football. Now it's up to you, players. And if we don't have football, it's on the players. So it puts a little more pressure on the players' side.
You mentioned the canceling of the Hall of Fame game, which was supposed to have happened on August 7th. How big a deal is that?
Well, I think it's significant. Now, the game itself is not really a showcase. It's more the events around it when you're inducting new members into the Hall of Fame. But, you know, we've heard all along that this agreement bill could be hammered out pretty quickly if both sides were committed to it. But there was a stretch there in April and May when they weren't even talking. And the idea was, let's get together and talk about it. And once we do, we should be able to hammer this out. The fact that they haven't been able to do that and they have to cancel a game, to me, that's significant, even though it's the first preseason game on the calendar. So I think while some might say, well, it's only one game, to me, it's actually a pretty big deal.
The specifics and the details notwithstanding, does this look like a fair agreement for both sides as far as you can tell?
Well, you know, the points I read over, I really did think that certain sides gave in areas that they didn't want to initially. So, for example, I think players wanted to have the franchise tag, that tag that would limit a player from changing teams and maybe cashing in on the unrestricted market, only be allowed to be applied once to a single player, but they sort of gave that up in exchange for other things like health and safety rules, where now teams won't be allowed to have two practices in a single day during training camp. So I think each side, those are just two examples, but I think both sides gave a little bit here, and usually to me that's a sign of a fair agreement when maybe neither side is completely happy with what's there.
After Thursday's vote, the owners insisted that the players' union recertify. Why did they press for that?
Well, without getting into the big legal issues here, Bill, I think the main thing is that by having the players form that union again, it basically protects the league from really being vulnerable to any antitrust law issues. And so when you look at that why they've sort of insisted to say if this agreement goes through, it's contingent on the union recertifying, that's the main issue, that antitrust issue.
What's your best guess about when the training camps will open and when the preseason games will begin, assuming that they will?
Well, at this point, Bill, I'm going to say that they're going to play those first preseason games, August 11th to 15th. They're still targeting that. I don't think we're past the date where those games couldn't be played, but I think we're getting close. I think you have to be in training camp within the first few days of August for that to happen. So I really think we're in crunch time here. I know I said last week we were at the goal line. If I could take it back, maybe I could say we were at the 2 last week, and maybe now we're at the 1, and it's the longest yard here to get to this finish line, to get past the goal line.
Mike Reese covers the NFL for ESPNBoston.com. Mike, thanks again.
Thanks, Bill.
Tomorrow in Cooperstown, New York, the Baseball Hall of Fame will enshrine 12-time All-Star second baseman Roberto Alomar, former Blue Jays, Orioles, Mariners, and Phillies general manager Pat Gillick, and pitcher Bert Blyleven, who won 287 games in the bigs. Their plaques will be on display beside those of other baseball greats, both living and dead, including two former Negro Leaguers whose graves, until recently, had been anonymous. Only a Game's Greg Eklund has that story.
Let it resound loud as the rolling sea.
Last month, on a sunny and humid Saturday morning, there was a small gathering at Mount Hope Cemetery in Topeka, Kansas. The occasion was the celebration of the life of former Kansas City Monarchs second baseman Carol Ray Dink Mothel, who died in 1980. Mothel's grave remained unmarked until that day, but it is no more, thanks to the diligent work of the Negro League's Grave Marker Project, a Society of American Baseball Research committee.
This is a 22nd marker we've been able to place since we've started the Grave Marker Project in 2004. Thank you.
That's Jeremy Kroc, the project's front man. He was on hand for the celebration of Mothel, who has no living relatives. Also attending were friends, neighbors, and about a dozen baseball fans. Historian Phil Dixon recited a poem at the ceremony. The poem's final passage reflected the trails blazed by Mothel and others before Jackie Robinson, who broke Major League Baseball's color line in 1947.
So God bless you, Jackie Robinson and Willie Mays and all. You wore our numbers on your backs when you played big league ball. And every time you hit one out, slid or laid one down, you carried us from that old bus to the halls of Cooperstown. Now, my name is Dink Mothel, but you won't remember that. I'm just one more along the score that played with ball and bat. But when you seek out heroes and you praise the great pastime, Remember those old brown-faced pros, the stars that did not shine. Thank you so much, and thank you for coming today.
Among those stars are J. Preston Pete Hill, who had his best days in the Negro Leagues as a center fielder from the turn of the century until the 1920s. He died in 1951 and was inducted into baseball's Hall of Fame in 2006. Sol White also played around the turn of the century, but about the time his career was winding down as a player-manager for the Philadelphia Giants in 1909, White became better known for authoring the earliest piece on African-American baseball history. It's called Sol White's Official Baseball Guide. White died in 1955 and was also enshrined in 2006. Until recently, the burial locations of Hill and White were unknown, but Hill's unmarked gravesite has been tracked down in suburban Chicago, and White's is traced to Staten Island, New York.
I think they are really deserving. They didn't have an opportunity to play in the major leagues, and their full earning potential was never realized.
That's 78-year-old George Altman, who played in the Negro Leagues and Major Leagues. His Major League career started with the Chicago Cubs as an outfielder in 1959, but Altman's professional career started with the Kansas City Monarchs in 1955.
Well, I think that was a great time in my life because I really was excited about, first of all, playing pro ball. And the other thing was playing in the Negro League and playing on the same grounds and fields of some of the guys that I had heard so much about.
As an outside observer, Altman applauds the Sabre Committee for its work on tracking down lost gravesites, thus keeping the story of the Negro Leagues players alive.
I think it's a great thing that what they're doing. They're going back and trying to put a marker on the graves of these people.
When Jeremy Kroc isn't traveling around the country for graveside ceremonies, he's an anesthesiologist in Peoria, Illinois. His work began after discovering the unmarked grave of Jimmy Crutchfield, an outfielder who reached his prime in the 1930s with several teams in the Negro Leagues. Crutchfield was a source of community pride in Ardmore, Missouri, once a thriving mining town, where Kroc's grandparents lived.
Now, this is the most famous man in Ardmore to come out of Ardmore, Missouri, and he's in an unmarked grave, and he was a Negro Leagues player, and I was perplexed as to far as why it was unmarked. I'm still perplexed.
When an unmarked grave of a former Negro Leagues player is discovered, Kroc and the committee set out to raise funds for the installation of a grave marker. Earlier this year in Clifton, New Jersey, a marker was placed on the grave of Frank Grant, a Hall of Fame second baseman who played in the pre-Negro Leagues from 1886 to 1903. Sol White's grave marker has been purchased and is scheduled to be installed later this year. That leaves Pete Hill as the only Hall of Famer whose grave marker is pending.
And the family has allowed us to undertake fundraising to place a grave marker there, and that's we're gonna start that soon. So hopefully 2012 will be all the Negro League players that are in the Hall of Fame will have grave markers.
Searches are still underway for dozens of Negro Leagues players with unmarked graves who are not in the Hall of Fame. For Only a Game, I'm Greg Eklund.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. The United Kingdom's backwards-running championships won't take place for another few weeks, but some of the more highly rated competitors proved last weekend that they are in top form. At the William Hill London Backward Run in Crystal Park on Sunday, current world champion backward runner Garrett Doherty, a.k.a. turned in a nifty 3-minute, 43-second run over the 1-kilometer course. His time for the 3-kilometer run was a mere 12 minutes, 42 seconds, which left over 100 other competitors wondering what Mr. Doherty was up to up front, or back there, or something. The winner in the women's division was, I beg your pardon, Meg Molt. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, I'll be meeting with some people who say baseball isn't just for boys, and with the girls who prove it. But first, Yao Ming's decision to retire was no surprise. The Houston Rockets said they'd be happy to sign him to a new contract if he was healthy, but the 7'6" center hasn't been healthy for years. During his 8 seasons in the NBA, Yao missed 250 regular season games, and he played just 5 games during the past 2 seasons. While his impact on the NBA was limited by injuries, his impact on basketball in China has been immeasurable. Joining me now on the line from Beijing is journalist Dan Levin. Dan, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks so much. Happy to be here.
We've known of Yao's decision to retire for weeks, but when it became official on Wednesday, China Central Television aired 5 hours of continuous coverage. Was his retirement really important enough to warrant that sort of attention?
Well, I think, that really brings up an important point with the cult of Yao. I think, this is a major kind of propaganda vehicle. And I think China Central Television, which is state-run TV, devotes hours like that. I think they're really trying to send a message to the people, to viewers, which is that, this is important. And I think that in this case, Yao represents the best of China. He's really kind of boosted patriotism because China has been able to see him as this favorite son who not only helped popularize basketball here in China, but also proved to the West that the Chinese can be just as good, if not better, than the West on their own court.
I'm just curious, how do you fill 5 hours of a tribute to a retiring basketball player on television?
I think it's a lot of ESPN reruns. I think what you're seeing is just Olympic footage. You're seeing Houston Rockets footage. And there's really no shortage. I mean, the man is in many ways a god in China. So, I think you're just seeing a lot of amazing plays by the man that, everyone's come to revere.
During the past 9 NBA seasons, those of us in the U.S. have really gotten used to seeing Yao's smiling face on commercials for computers and cell phones and credit cards, all sorts of things. I would imagine he's been even more omnipresent in Chinese society.
He is ubiquitous. I think he's not only peddling this image of Chinese as incredibly athletically talented, but he is selling everything from technology and consumer goods to he's even been on public service announcements. There's this major campaign, Don't Eat Shark Fin Soup, and it had Yao's face. And so that, I think, was a really interesting little aspect in how they've learned from the West how to leverage famous faces to promote social causes, and in this case, sort of environmental causes.
Yao has said that he will return to his former Chinese team, the Shanghai Sharks, with the hope of becoming general manager there. The Chinese Basketball Association hasn't had a lot of success capitalizing on the rising popularity of the game in China. Will the return, albeit not a return to the court, of their biggest star help in that effort?
I think so. I think he's very committed. I mean, he, a few years ago, bought the team. So I think it's in his interest, both as owner and I think also as a player and a citizen, to see the Shanghai Sharks and the Chinese Basketball Association grow in popularity. He brought in a few years ago Bob Dunwall Jr., who's an American coach, to coach the Shanghai Sharks. Dunwall did that for 2 years, and now he's coaching the national team. So I think Yao really has a very sort of keen understanding of the strengths and weaknesses of Chinese basketball. And I think he's going to spend whatever time and money he can to see the game in this country really improve. I'm not sure, though, how effective he can be as one man. Other Chinese players who've gone to the NBA have not performed as well as he has. And there's that sort of growing awareness in this country that they've got to kind of start from the ground up in a way so that they don't just have to wait for the next Yao Ming, because who knows when that can come along.
Why has China's state-run athletic system been so successful at identifying and training athletes for sports such as gymnastics and diving and synchronized swimming, and yet not successful at developing more top-level basketball players?
They're just different sports. And what's happened in China is this kind of very Soviet-inspired model. I mean, you're talking about kids getting picked to sort of enter this training regime at age, you know, 8, 9, 10. You can't really pick out these star players that we know of in the West or certainly in the NBA at age 10. So I think that's a real flaw that the CBA, the Chinese Basketball Association, is starting to acknowledge that they've got to fix.
Not quite everybody is sad to see Yao Ming retire. For your article in the New York Times this week, you spoke with an amateur player named Li Nan. What was his point of view?
Li Nan, I think, speaks for a lot of amateur players in China. And, you know, by one estimate I saw, there's something like 300 million amateur basketball players in this country. He had a number of, I think, misgivings about sort of the role of Yao Ming and sort of the challenges that Chinese basketball is facing. He acknowledged that Yao Ming, right, as this 7'6" player, he was so unique that his kind of talent couldn't be replicated. And I think what Li Nan was saying was, you have 300 million Chinese amateur players, and they don't really get a shot. There's no access for them. There's no opportunity for them within the state sports system to get coached to the point where they're professional enough that they could go to the NBA or even really compete in Olympic basketball.
I wonder if Yao Ming agrees with that point of view and whether his involvement, his direct involvement with basketball in China now that he's no longer in the NBA will change things there.
He has a very tough job ahead, but I think if anyone can do it, he will. After 9 seasons in the NBA, he's pretty fluent at the strengths of how America trains its players, you know, from youth leagues to NCAA on up to the NBA. And I think he's going to bring a lot of that understanding to the system. Officials within the state system are going to listen to him.
Dan Levin is a journalist based in Beijing. His article on Yao Ming's retirement appeared in the New York Times this week. Dan, thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Oh, I'm loving this cage.
Baseball camp is about baseball, of course, which means every camper gets a turn in the batting cage, and they all get advice.
And keep your weight back because curveballs are going to be coming at you instead of away.
The instructor on Tuesday afternoon at a baseball camp in western Massachusetts is Michaela Seiler, a former Little League All-Star who pitches for a high school team in Florida. The hitter with whom she's working is a 13-year-old named Jackie, who's come to the camp from Toronto and who has to like at least some of what her coach has to say.
It's all there. She's just got to get it all on point, going at the same time. And once she gets that, I mean, she'll be hitting way farther than she's been. And she's already knocking the crap out of the ball. She's still a little off with her swing. And as long as she, you know, gets the key points down, she's going to be phenomenal at bat.
Michaela Seiler knows whereof she speaks. She's been playing baseball since early childhood. By the time she was 12, she was playing it well enough to join a girls' team that traveled to Australia for a series of games under the auspices of an organization called Baseball for All, the same organization running the camp where Michaela is coaching. Like most of the girls at the camp, she learned the game on a boys' team, and it was a challenge.
You're the only girl on a whole team of boys, and you got to work 10 times harder, and you have to be on your best behavior because all they want to do is to push you down because you're going against what people normally know, and they don't like that. So a lot of the times, it's hard to keep fighting when everyone else is telling you to stop fighting.
Many of the ball players at this camp are the only girls on their teams back home, but some of them are less challenged in that circumstance than Michaela Seiler has been. Trinity Gonzalez flew to Massachusetts with her mom from 29 Palms, California, where Trinity, who is 11, is the only girl on her travel team. She's a catcher, and she's good enough so that each time the team's best pitcher starts, he wants Trinity behind the plate.
Well, we're best friends, and we've been playing together since I was 5 and he was 6 years old. And we started a travel ball team, So we play year-round together. And I was just the catcher the whole time.
And boy, with all that catcher's equipment on, you must nearly disappear. You're not very big. How tall are you?
I'm 4'8".
4'8". How'd you pick catcher?
Well, I tried all the positions when I was little, and I didn't like any of them. So I the only one I didn't try was catcher, and I really liked it because you get to see what's going on and stuff.
As Trinity stepped in for her turn in the batting cage, I spoke with her mother, Leslie, who's 100% behind her daughter's determination to stay with baseball rather than shift to softball, as girls are so often pressured to do.
You know, they want it just as bad as the boys, so I feel if they have the skill and can get it done, what's the difference?
Leslie Gonzalez has another daughter who plays on her high school softball team and a son who was drafted by the Marlins, an advantage, I'd think, for an 11-year-old catcher, no matter that catcher's gender.
He works with her a lot, and her dad works with her a lot. He coaches her travel ball team and stuff, so we'll see.
That's great.
Let them take it as far as they can.
Besides instruction in hitting, fielding, base running, and the various other skills associated with the game, campers learn something about baseball's sometimes arcane rules. On the afternoon of my visit, there was a seminar on the balk.
Now, if the pitcher gets the ball, they might still want to trick the runner, right? Okay? Say the pitcher has the ball.
Eventually, a veteran umpire named Barry Barber figured that maybe it was time for a seventh-inning stretch in this seminar. She hauled out her guitar, and suddenly the summer baseball camp began to sound a lot like, well, just summer camp. Let me root, root, root for the home. The following day, the campers got on a bus and headed for Boston, where they'd get a late afternoon tour of Fenway Park. But first, there was baseball to be played. The girls associated with Baseball for All spread out over two diamonds to play with and against a group of boys attending a baseball camp at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Among the most interested observers was Justine Siegel, who founded Baseball for All a decade ago. She said she'd been asking the campers to tell her about what they liked best in the program.
They say two things. One is the friends they're making, and the second is they like playing against the boys.
On the first play of the game I was watching, one of the boys cracked a sharp grounder to third, where one of the Baseball for All campers fielded the ball and fired it to first, beating the runner by several steps. I asked Justine Siegel whether male hitters put out by girls or male pitchers who gave up hits to female batters were still likely to hear about it from their teammates.
Yeah, I think it's still set up in the culture, but most of that is adult-driven, and the kids, you gain their respect pretty quickly. So once the adults sort of keep their own fears out, the kids just respect each other's ball players and want to go have fun.
And maybe she's right. As I watched that game on Wednesday afternoon, I found that I was paying less attention to the genders of the players and more attention to how well they were playing, which, according to Justine Siegel, is a big part of what Baseball for All is about.
You know, that's my goal. My goal is that this is no longer a news story, and girls and boys are playing baseball. It's our national pastime, and to me, it's the greatest game on earth.
The campers at Baseball for All no doubt agree, and many of them will return from camp to the teams on which they are the only girls, secure in the conviction that lots of other Michaelas and Justines, Trinities and Jackies share that opinion. You're listening to Only a Game. Only a Media Game listeners fall into two categories, those who think we don't pay enough attention to football, baseball, and basketball, and those who think we should feature a story on the Bluegrass Classic Stock Dog Trail, which involves dog, sheep, obstacles, and a time limit. Peter Cook of Lexington, Kentucky, is in the latter camp. Peter, thank you very much for your suggestion. Another Kentucky listener, Ernie Henninger, who hears the program on WUKY, has suggested a change in the name of the show. Every Saturday I tune in, he wrote, and after the latest installment featuring sandcastles, a book review, a court case discussion that lasted longer than the court case, and buffalo chips, I wonder if the program intends to change from only a game to it's not even a game. No. A couple of weeks ago, I talked with Charlie Rosen, the author of a book titled Crazy Basketball. Some of what Mr. Rosen said about various incidents that had occurred during his coaching career in the Continental Basketball Association irked Tarina Mosley. She emailed to say Mr. Rosen's reference to a, quote, inner-city-looking guy whom he did not sign had her asking, how many people of color have had to deal with that issue? Interestingly enough, Reagan Truesdale, the guy Coach Rosen didn't want to drop from his roster in order to sign the other player, is black. But Ms. Mosley couldn't have known that, and the phrase inner-city-looking guy did set off alarms elsewhere as well, such as between my ears. Sarah Stewart emailed to comment on the same interview and wondered why I didn't ask Charlie Rosen whether the player he elected to keep was white. Last week I spoke with the authors of The Swinger, a novel based in part on the misadventures of Tiger Woods, and that conversation prompted David Cookellen to email as follows. I heard one of the authors say the central character was created from whole cloth. The rest of the interview was about Tiger Woods as much as it was about the fictional golfer. That would seem to indicate that my understanding of whole cloth is in error. It sounded like the fictional character was a patchwork of various aspects of Tiger Woods' personality, and each of those patches had a Nike logo on it. If you'd like to comment on something you've heard on the program, visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can also leave a message on the listener line, 617-353-1860. You can write us at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. And you can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only a Game Radio. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Harvard University, whose Harvard Extension School has online and on-campus courses for students around the world, extension.harvard.edu. And Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. This is NPR.
He's the man with all the toys.
The ground trembled near Copenhagen last weekend as big-bellied Santas from all over the world gathered for the 54th World Santa Claus Congress. The five-discipline competition highlighted the event, and the team of Santas from Denmark prevailed. The Danish Santas excelled at throwing sacks of presents, mastering a Christmas obstacle course, and riding bumper cars, which must have been decorated with colored lights and tinsel, or it just would have been stupid. Santas from the U.S., Sweden, Russia, Germany, and several other countries failed in their attempts to earn recognition as the best Santa team, but they are expected to recover so that their bellies will shake like bowls full of jelly when they laugh by December, which is perhaps why this competition takes place in July. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, we meet the fastball pitcher whose glory days were immortalized in, well, glory days. But first, Charlie Pierce is on the line for our weekly conversation about the news. Charlie, how you doing?
Hi, Bill.
Our long national nightmare is over, or at least it's close to over, or at least it might be. Have you stocked up on face paint and made sure your tailgating grill has sufficient propane?
I'm already gearing up to ridicule the whole notion of going to training camp.
Good, you're prepared. The owners and players seem to agree that doing away with two-a-day practices in training camp is a good idea, but New York Jets linebacker Bart Scott told the Newark Star-Ledger, and I'm quoting now, I think it's wimping out and making football more soft. So is it fair to conclude Mr. Scott has already taken too many hits to the head?
Mr. Scott is once again confusing his profession with his testosterone count. Two a days in this kind of weather is crazy to start with. There is absolutely no reason to do them. You can get ready and play a perfectly adequate game of National Football League football for people to bet on, whether or not you have two a days or not.
You're in mid-season form.
Thank you. I'm ready to go. I didn't care about the lockout. I've been working out on my own.
This week, the Ivy League announced a plan to minimize head injuries among players there. Football teams will be allowed 2 full contact practices per week instead of the maximum of 5 under NCAA rules. I know there's a joke in there somewhere about the relative value of players' brains when the players are Ivy Leaguers, but maybe I ought to leave you with the opportunity to make that joke.
Oh, it looks like the Ivy League's doing a sensible thing here, and I'm not going to make the obvious joke about the relative value of people's brains.
Good.
All
Excellent.
Brains are equally valuable. What we do with them, on the other hand, is a whole different thing.
In case you were getting the tubes in your TV set warmed up for the start of the college football season in September, don't bother. CBSSports.com's Tom Fornelli has simulated the entire season via video game, and the national champion is South Carolina.
I would like Tom to take his video game to Las Vegas and invest heavily on that proposition, because I think he's going to wind up without his video game or his clothes. The good thing from your standpoint, Bill, is now you don't have to pay attention to college football.
Yeah, and I was gonna.
I know.
Would you like to know the name of the 2011 Heisman Trophy winner? Because Mr. Fornelli has figured that out as well.
Hold it 1 second.
Yeah, okay, there's the post. There's the post. Okay, well, it's Houston's Case Keenum.
No, that's not going to happen. They're not going to give the Heisman Trophy to another player from the University of Houston. That's not going to happen. Tom and his computer are wrong.
All right, time for a quick quiz. Last weekend, the Atlanta Braves became the 3rd franchise in Major League history to reach 10,000 wins. Can you name the other 2 teams that have done that?
The Worcester Rubylegs.
That's a very interesting guess, but it's wrong.
All right, my guess would be the Los Angeles knee Brooklyn Dodgers and the Oakland knee Kansas City knee Philadelphia Athletics.
Ah, see, I guessed the Giants right away, and I was right. I had them. But the other one is the Cubs.
Really?
Yeah. All you have to do is hang around a long time.
10,000 wins and no World Series since 1908. Well done.
Baseball players are featured on baseball cards all the time, Charlie. So why is it news that San Francisco Giants closer Brian Wilson is featured in Topps' latest offering?
Because his beard has its own card, Bill. And I think that we're having beard trading cards is right up there. I can make a little money on this.
Charlie Pierce's beard, number 301.
There we are. Absolutely. I'll get my beard's rookie card. My grandchildren can have make a fortune on it.
The NBA has revealed its 2011-2012 schedule under the caveat that it only applies if the league and its players' association reach an agreement on time, and there actually is a 2011-2012 season. So, what do you think? What's the chance we'll see the Dallas Mavericks host the Chicago Bulls on November the 1st?
Slim to none at all. I think the NBA may well be playing merely a 2012 schedule.
The NBA has apparently already fined 2 teams for speaking about players during the lockout. The league isn't saying who was fined or how much the fine was, but since the league threatened to fine Blazers general manager Chad Buchanan $1 million for answering one word, yeah, to the suggestion that the cancellation of the summer league was unfortunate, I got to think they're serious about this.
Well, I got to think that you might well be into 9 and 10 figures if you actually use a verb.
Yeah, a complete sentence would get you in serious trouble here.
You'd go to jail for that.
Turkish teams are allowed to speak about NBA players all they want, of course, and one such team has said that it is a fact that they're talking with Kobe Bryant about playing for them. What are the odds that Kobe Bryant will actually subject his ailing knees to Turkish basketball courts?
I think you put your finger on it. I think if he was at all healthy, he might actually do it because he is a man of the world. His first name is Japanese. His father played overseas. He's always talked about possibly playing overseas. But I do think his knees will keep him from doing it this time.
Abby Wambach returned from the Women's World Cup in Germany to a hero's welcome, at least at home, when her WPS team, Magic Jack, took on the Western New York Flash. Wambach did not play in the game, and, of course, the U.S. lost to Japan in the final of the World Cup, so I don't care how many people showed up. She's a big loser, right?
Absolutely. absolutely big loser. No, you got to like to be able to get home and get received by a hero and then not have to play the game.
Yeah, she said she was very tired, which I can understand. You know, it was a long World Cup.
Yes, losing to Japan is exhausting.
And finally, Charlie David L. Warner Jr., 36, won the small car division of the Demolition Derby at a Kentucky County Fair, and very shortly thereafter, he was arrested for driving drunk during the competition. He will appear in court on Tuesday. But do you think his successful pre-race routine of several Bud Lights is going to catch on amongst Demolition Derby drivers?
Hey, you're supposed to hit something! I look upon it as an example of performance-enhancing drugs myself, because you can't have sober people and drunk people in the same Demolition Derby. The drunk people have far too much of an advantage.
Charlie Pierce is the author of Idiot America and several other books. He joins me each week at this time. Thank you very much, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
While most fans of pro football were preoccupied with the question of whether there would be a full season in 2011, or any season at all, another NFL-related story broke this week. On Tuesday, a group of 75 retired NFL players filed a lawsuit charging the league with misrepresenting the consequences of the concussions players have regularly suffered while at work. Specifically, the 75 players cite the studies published by the league's Committee on Concussions. The committee was formed almost 20 years ago, and until 2010, the doctors and others associated with it maintained that there was no evidence that those concussions had long-term effects. Last year, for the first time, the NFL began warning players about the consequences of multiple concussions. New rules were instituted to ensure that players who have suffered concussions are not rushed back onto the field before their brains have recovered. But the players filing this week's lawsuit, many of whom retired before 1994, maintain that throughout their careers they were improperly diagnosed by medical personnel employed by the teams. As recently as 2007, the NFL was distributing to players a pamphlet debunking the connection between concussions and problems with brain function after the players had retired. NFL spokesman Greg Aiello responded to the charge that the league had, quote, acted willfully, wantonly, egregiously, with reckless abandon and a high degree of moral culpability toward its employees by saying the NFL would, quote, vigorously contest any claims of this kind. Throughout the months of the lockout, there has been much discussion about what compensation retired players who've suffered from various physical, mental, or psychological problems might get as a result of a settlement between the league and the current players. At the very least, the lawsuit filed on Tuesday will pump up the volume on that aspect of the discussion of the relationship between the league and the players. At most, it may change the way we all come to understand the responsibility of employer to employee when the workplace is a field of play. Bruce Springsteen's song Glory Days hit number 5 on the Billboard charts in 1985, and since then it's been a staple at ballparks from the Little League to the Bigs. The song centers around a melancholy and nameless former high school pitcher who can't help but talk about his prime long after it has passed. Now we know who that pitcher is, and Vermont Public Radio's Kirk Carapazza recently caught up with him in a small resort town that sits in the heart of the Green Mountains.
Joe DePew says there was never any question about it.
I knew the song was about me as soon as I heard it.
That was back in 1984, the summer Bruce Springsteen released his best-selling album, Born in the USA. DePew was raised in Freehold, New Jersey, Springsteen's hometown. He went to school and played Little League with a rock star.
He was always terrible in sports. My nickname for him was Saddy because we kind of rated the kids in the classroom according to ability. So the really good kids were bad and the really bad kids were sad. So he was always Saddy.
After high school, DePew says the two friends lost touch. While Saddy was becoming the boss, DePew was pitching at King's College in central Pennsylvania. He would eventually get a tryout with the Dodgers, but he says his chances of making the majors were always slim to none. And by the time Glory Days hit the airwaves in the summer of 84, DePew's playing career was over. He was married and working in Vermont as a contractor, And DePue says one of his business partners named Scotty Wright was a huge Springsteen fan.
So whenever something by Springsteen came on, he'd crank it up, you know. And so at lunch one day, I told him, I said, you know, him and I grew up together. You know, we got plunked together in Sister Teresa Mary's class and ended up playing Little League together and then Babe Ruth League. And, you know, and I just kept telling him stories.
Later that summer, DePue and Wright were out with a group of friends.
And during dinner, Scott says to me, Springsteen's got a new album out. And he said, there's a song on there about you. And I said, yeah, right.
So after dinner, his friend called WNCS, the rock station in Montpelier, and requested Glory Days.
Half hour later, the guy comes on the radio and he says, this is going out to Scotty Wright up in Stowe, Vermont. You know, this is the new Springsteen song, Glory Days. And apparently it's about a friend of Scott's. So here you go, Scott. And it comes on, you know, I had a friend back in high school. He could throw that ball by you, make you look like a fool. Saw him the other night at this roadside bar. I was walking in, he was walking out. And we went back inside and all we kept talking about. So right then I knew, you know, my wife starts bawling, she's crying, you know. So that's when we found out.
The first verse of Glory Days paints a universal picture of two long-lost friends reuniting at a roadside bar. One was walking in, the other walking out. That's exactly how Joe DePue remembers it. After graduating from college, he was back on the Jersey Shore looking for work in the summer of 73. He was living with a woman who had three kids from another marriage. And one night, he stopped at a bar for a few beers.
I had to get going about 9:30. So I headed out the door, and I'm walking down the pathway there to my car, and here comes Springsteen. And at this point, now I hadn't seen him since we graduated. So this is 5 or 6 years has gone by, and he is just starting to become a name. We went back in and ended up closing the place till like 1:30 in the morning, just talking about old times, you know, and the nuns and, you know, games and stuff and everything.
We can see echoes of ourselves in all of his songs.
This is Kevin Coyne, the borough historian in Freehold, New Jersey. He's a shameless Springsteen fan, and he's also wondered who the pitcher is in Glory Days.
And I always thought it was this one person in particular. I thought it was this guy, Jimmy Mavrolian. And a lot of people in town thought it was this guy, Jimmy Mavrolian, who was a year ahead of Bruce in school and was the star pitcher. He played in the minor leagues, the Reds minor league organization.
Coyne coaches Little League in Freehold, where he also played as a kid. And at a reunion this season, one of his teammates, Don Norcus, said he knew who the Glory Days pitcher was.
So I said, all right, Don, who is it? And he said, it was Joe DePue. And I said, Joe DePue? That's not who we thought it was. To me, this was like big news because, you know, as the Freehold Borough historian, my two primary duties are going to the fourth grade each year and telling them about the Battle of Monmouth, which was the largest single land battle of the American Revolution, which was fought here on the soil of Freehold, New Jersey. And my second duty is to shepherd visiting Scandinavian journalists through the Bruce sites, because Bruce is very big in Scandinavia, and whenever he's on tour or has an album out, some wispy guys with ponytails show up, and they said, show me baseball field. And so we go to the baseball field, and I give him the whole tour.
Peter Carlin isn't from Scandinavia, but he is a journalist and a Springsteen biographer. He also thought the Glory Days pitcher was someone else.
Well, I was a little surprised because the smart money always seemed to settle on Lance Rowe, who was the son of the coach of, I believe, Bruce's team.
Carlin thinks Joe DePue has a convincing story, but he says the most important thing to him as a biographer is that Springsteen has always had genuine empathy for day-to-day people.
No matter whose voice he's singing in, he can channel his own visceral experience into someone else's life. And, you know, and tell their story with the same amount of passion and sensitivity as they would tell it themselves.
These days, Joe DePue is still working as a contractor in central Vermont.
And now, to honor America with the singing of our national anthem.
The night of the Major League All-Star Game, DePue visits a house that he's fixing up in Stowe. On a TV in the basement, American Idol Jordan Sparks sings the national anthem, as DePue explains the repairs he's doing to the flood-damaged house.
They had leaks all over the place, and I had to replace a lot of the sheetrock.
When he's not talking shop, you know, DePue still likes to tell stories about his playing days.
You know, I had a fastball that tailed away from a right-hand hitter. I had a fastball that rose. Depending on how you grip it, four-seam, two-seam, with the seams, against the seams, you can make it move how you want.
At 61 years old, he says for a long time he thought about what could have been.
And then the curveball, you know, in Little League, I just always used to throw it sidearm. And when I got to Babe Ruth League, the guy said to me,
but with his big frame resting on the couch, DePue says at some point he stopped dreaming about it. He sits back, has a few beers, and watches the game. And he says today he's just humble and grateful for being revealed as the hero, sad or otherwise, of this song. For Only a Game, I'm Kirk Carapezza.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Allison Gluck. We had help this week from Paul Vikas, Maria Carter, and Andrea Salenzi at KCUR in Kansas City. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our Glory Days photo gallery and girls' baseball pictures or learn more about this week's music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from ex-fireballer Joe DePue, who poses this rhetorical question.
Would you rather have the autograph of the actual pitcher from Glory Days or just the guy that writes songs about him?
Joe, I gotta be honest with you. I'd rather have the boss's autograph, even at the risk of taking one under the chin from you. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. This is NPR.